nós temos que enfrentar os nossos problemas. Chega de frescura.
Stop this fussing and whining. How long will you keep crying? We have to face the problems.
Enfrentar os problemas.
Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro speaking at an event back in March, telling Brazilians to get back to work, even as the country is reeling from a surge in COVID cases. Brazil has now recorded more than 400,000 deaths, second only to the United States. The pain is spreading to other South American countries. Even though India now accounts for 50% of new cases worldwide, Uruguay now has one of the highest per capita caseloads in the world. Peru, Colombia, Argentina, Venezuela, they're also in crisis mode. Many of the continent's leaders put the blame squarely on Brazil and Bolsonaro for not doing more to contain the deadly variant there. Here to tell us more is Julie Turkowitz, Andy's bureau chief for the New York Times. She's based in Bogota. Welcome to Press Play.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us what it's like in Bogota and in Colombia in general.
Sure. Yes, the country is definitely in crisis. We are seeing a third wave here in Bogota as well as in the country. We've seen the highest daily death tolls since this pandemic began, and that is a number that just keeps getting beat and beat and beat every day. On top of that, the country is in the midst of nationwide protests that are very much linked to frustration over the pandemic, over sickness, over growing poverty, growing inequality, growing unemployment. And so we're really seeing this crisis spiral outwards.
Right. And not only there in Colombia, but also you reported on Peru, also facing not only a COVID crisis, but an economic one.
Definitely. Peru is reflective of much of the region in that it has seen an enormous drop in GDP in the last year. I believe its economy shrank 12% last year alone. Across the region, that number is 7%. And so these are sort of parallel crises.
And this is especially heartbreaking because many of these countries, Peru included, were on the upswing before the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, over the last two decades or so across the region, you've really seen a rising middle class, many people who have crawled their way out of poverty, who saw better lives for their children. That is true in Colombia, it's true in Peru, it's true in many other places. And for many of those families, this crisis, because of stopped work, because of lack of savings, because the government, in many cases, has only stepped in or can only step in to help so much, the pandemic and the associated economic crisis has really thrust a lot of people back into where their parents were or where their grandparents were economically.
Oh, wow. And you report on one man in particular as an example of this, who in Peru, who ended up in a, well, in a tent in a squatter's camp. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah. So Rafael is a father of three. He's 50 years old, and he is, I think, very representative of a lot of people across the region. He had what he believed to be a good job working in human resources for a local municipality. He had some kind of grip, or so he thought, on stability. And then the pandemic came and he became sick in May of last year. He quickly lost his job. He began pulling money from his pension, which was something that was newly allowed by the Peruvian government to help people like him deal with the pandemic. He took out the maximum amount of money, is now has mounting debts, can barely pay for his kids to get a little bit of cell phone data so they can try and do their schoolwork because they're still in virtual school. And on top of that, his wife gave birth to twins last year, and she had them prematurely. He believes it is because of so much stress. And both of those twins died shortly after being born.
Oh my gosh.
So recently he became one of thousands of people who occupied an unoccupied part of Lima in order to try and find some kind of home. He is renting and is near eviction and thought, okay, I'm going to, you know, take matters into my own hands. go to this hillside and pitch a tent and hope that this will grant me the rights to this land. He was among many, many people who did this, and then recently was booted out by the police and went back to this place where he believes he will be evicted very soon. And I wish dearly that I could say that he is a extreme case, but there are many, 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 many people, not only in Peru, but across the region, who are in very similar situations.
Oh, that is heartbreaking and tragic. And it looks like there's no end in sight for now when it comes to the actual rate of infections.
The rate of infections is growing in many places. One of the major concerns is the P1 variant, which was first discovered in Brazil, and at least according to early studies, appears to be more transmissible and associated with higher death rates among young people and people without pre-existing conditions than the initial variant that we all were familiar with at the beginning of the virus. So there is definitely scientific reason to believe that, unfortunately, things are just going to get worse.
And do these other countries, do people in these other countries and their leaders, do they blame Brazil for that?
Yes, there is definitely an anger at Brazil, I believe, among officials, among authorities, among everyday people, not just because of this variant, but because of the policies put in place by Brazil as other countries tried to be responsible. And of course, you know, what happened in Brazil spills into other countries because the borders are porous. So there's certainly anger at Brazil. There is also, though, a call for by health ministers for, you know, everyday civilians to please, please, please wear your masks, stay inside if you can, pay attention to social distancing. We know, like they say, we know you are so tired of this, but please, you know, try and protect yourselves, ourselves,
and
all of us.
And speaking of the vaccine, very few people have received the vaccine.
Very few people have received the vaccine. You know, wealthier countries bought up the vaccines ahead of other nations. And so countries have limited supplies. And as of last week, and the number is probably pretty similar, Colombia had given a first vaccine to about 6% of its population. And some of its neighbors had been able to vaccinate even fewer than that. So a lot of public health officials are calling on richer nations to please, please help. You know, the sort of the public health of South America, of Latin America, affects the public health of the globe.
Well, Julie, thank you. And thank you for your reporting.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
Julie Turkowitz, Andes bureau chief for The New York Times. Coming up, how Caitlyn Jenner puts trans activists in a difficult position. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand, reality TV star and California gubernatorial hopeful Caitlyn Jenner is in the headlines yet again for another controversial policy position. Over the weekend, she was asked what she thinks about trans girls competing in girls' sports, and she said she's against it, suggesting support for a growing Republican movement to pass laws prohibiting trans athletes in girls' sports. Five Republican-led state legislatures have passed bills doing just that. More than two-thirds of states are considering similar legislation. Not exactly a popular position here in deep blue California, but Jenner, who's trans, and her run for governor are making trans activists deeply uncomfortable. Dawn Ennis is managing editor at Outsports, and she wrote about the position Jenner has put trans activists in for Forbes. Welcome to Press Play, Dawn.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Well, those comments over the weekend have been upsetting for a lot of advocates, but you have interviewed Caitlyn Jenner multiple times where she has said something different. Tell us about that.
Well, I interviewed her back in 2016 when she said she wanted to be Ted Cruz's trans ambassador. That didn't go over so well. Mm-hmm. And then I interviewed her a couple more times, but most recently, in April of last year, she was a guest on our Outsports podcast, The Trans Sporter Room. It's a sci-fi Star Trek sports kind of thing with trans women. It's fun. And Caitlin came on to talk about that she is done with politics. And then she said this.
You know, I think every trans person, if they're into athletics, should have an opportunity to compete and to improve themselves. I think sports is such a great way to learn a lot about yourself. And I want to, hopefully they'll have the opportunity in the future to do whatever they can do. So
that was basically Caitlyn Jenner completely saying the opposite of what she just said.
Huh.
And the worst part for me and for a lot of trans people is that she didn't say trans girls. She called them biological boys, which is just, it's misgendering. It's not factual. And it's playing into the hands of the people who are opposed to trans inclusion.
Right. And so what do you make of her apparent flip-flop?
I think this is a political move. She has turned this political campaign now into a complete disaster, because even if she was going to be the next Arnold Schwarzenegger, she's running on a platform that doesn't even exist in California. California is not going to roll back rights for transgender people. She's appealing directly to those GOP donors in hopes of either a cash grab or attention or both.
The fact that she was an Olympic athlete and a much decorated Olympic athlete, does that give her any credibility on this topic?
I think that if she had persistently said that this is where she believes trans athletes should be, like Dr. Renee Richards, who was a pioneer in the trans world and played against Martina Navratilova. She has always said that she doesn't think that trans athletes should compete against cisgender athletes, especially if they haven't had either surgery or hormone replacement. And Caitlin has not done that. Caitlin has been very much an advocate, has posed with trans children, has talked about, even at the ESPYs, about how she wants to represent the children. And now she's basically turning her back on them.
Hmm. And do you take her run for governor seriously? Do you think that she could actually pull it off a la Schwarzenegger?
I don't think so, because, first of all, let's put aside the fact that she hasn't voted in nine of the last 20 elections. Put that aside. Schwarzenegger was always engaged. I used to live in LA, so I know a little bit about this. He was engaged with people. He talked about education. He's still engaged. He may have been a movie star and a bodybuilder, but he knows politics. Caitlin only knows what her Republican base tell her, what she reads on Breitbart, what she's watching on Fox. And I really have to be honest, I didn't expect her to become a Democrat when she came out, but I think people forgot. This is a rich old white lady living above the clouds in Malibu. She's not someone who's woke, doesn't understand the marginalized experience, and she has access to all the things that every trans person would ever dream of having: finances, friends, support. And for most trans people, it's a very lonely existence. We lose our homes, we lose our marriages, we lose those people who we thought would always stand by us, we lose our children. Now, Caitlin's gone through some of that, but she hasn't suffered the way most trans people do. And what I think is important is that this is not a trans person running for governor. This is a celebrity running for governor who happens to be trans. And anybody who calls her an activist needs to have their head checked.
And so she is not well-loved in the trans community?
There are people who do adore her. I'm not going to deny it. I certainly was a fan because I heard her talk to Diane Sawyer about things that I had never been able to express. But I will say this, even though she is inspirational to a lot of people, this has turned so many people off. Basically because these are kids. These are just kids who want to compete like every other kid. How can you say no to that? I understand this is about fairness. As a mom, I also want my kids to have every opportunity. But I've also taught them all their lives, life isn't fair. Sometimes you lose. And these parents who are opposed to trans inclusion don't get that.
So I wonder if she is doing more harm than good for the trans community. If she comes out and says this about trans athletes, what does that do for the rights of trans people?
It does three things. First of all, it turns a political campaign that had nothing to do with my community into making us a target once again. We are already fighting for our existence in states all across the country. Second, it makes people mock her, mock us. The old meme, oh, but she's a guy, or she's a dude, or he's a dude, whatever they want to say. All this comes back from the dregs where we try to hide it. There are people right now fighting in court in Idaho to try and change a law that bans trans athletes. And even the attorney for the ACLU, who is a trans man, is being called by one of these groups a woman. It's just the misgendering never stops. And what I don't think Caitlin understands is by taking this stance about trans athletes, she drags all of us into the mud with her, every one of us.
Dawn Ennis, managing editor at Outsports, and she wrote about Caitlyn Jenner for Forbes. Dawn, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline. A pleasure to talk to you.
Well, as Dawn just mentioned, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals takes up the issue of trans athletes in girls' sports today. At issue is an Idaho law that bans trans women and girls from competing on sports teams that correspond with their gender identity. It never went into effect. A judge blocked it. But now a bunch of other states have followed Idaho's lead and have passed similar legislation. This case could provide some clarity as to whether these laws amass constitutional scrutiny. It is Monday, and so our legal Jessica Levinson is here. She's law professor at Loyola Law School. Hi.
Hi.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning. Idaho's governor signed this bill into law last year. It never went into effect. What was the judge's reasoning for blocking it?
The district court judge in this case issued an injunction and said, this isn't going to go into effect because I think it's unconstitutional. And the district court judge really shot down a number of the defendant's arguments here, saying things like, it's absolutely still in dispute whether or not transgender women really have an athletic advantage. He said this categorical ban, this full-out prohibition, goes against what he said policies of elite athletic bodies that regulate sports both nationally and globally, by which he means organizations like the NCAA. And he said this could be really intrusive and burdensome when it comes to sex verification. And he said that doesn't square with our constitutional understandings of privacy either. So he really took to task the defendant's arguments here that this would be constitutional. And of course, it's the first law that we've seen like this, not the last, but it was the first full out prohibition on transgender people from kindergarten all the way through college.
Hmm. So you mentioned sex verification. Part of this law is actually verifying whether or not the athlete is trans.
So part of, in terms of whether or not you're implementing the prohibition, my understanding is that in the district court, there was a discussion about, well, how would we verify the sex mm-hmm. of the athletes? And so there could be, as the judge said, verification that is so burdensome and so intrusive that it actually violates the Constitution.
All right, so let's talk about the specifics of this particular case. It involves a Boise State University student named Lindsay Hecox. Tell us about her. She's trans and what her argument is.
Yeah, she's trans. She ran track and cross country in high school for the boys team before she transitioned. Now she's going through hormone suppressing treatment, and she said that she's seen her performance decline. And her argument is, look, I have no other way of participating in sports. And she makes a number of moral arguments, ethical arguments, but also legal arguments that this full-on prohibition is actually unconstitutional, as the judge agreed with her in the district court. And she's saying that, again, this is my only avenue for being able to compete.
Well, that raises an interesting idea. So in the law, does it provide any kind of help for trans girls who want to compete? Do they say, well, then if they're banned from competing in girls and women's sports, they have to be accepted into boys or men's sports? Is that in the law at all?
Not that I know of, but it's interesting that you ask that, because the defendants are really kind of hitching their wagons, is maybe not the right expression, but the defendants are leaning really heavily on Title IX, which says you have to categorically be in one bucket or the other. You have to either be playing as a part of women's sports or playing as a part of men's and boys' sports. And the defendants are saying this is really important because it actually protects women. And they're saying, like, even with this testosterone suppression that Lindsay is undergoing, that transgender women are still at an advantage. So it's not clear to me, to try and answer your question, that under the law, transgender women would have an opportunity to go, quote unquote, back into playing on the boys' team or running track and field for with boys instead.
And conversely, do the lawyers representing Lindsay, do they say, well, even if she weren't taking testosterone suppressing drugs, it is still unfair?
I don't know that they go there. I don't know that they say, even if she weren't taking the testosterone suppressing drugs, because that's part of their argument, which is that she said, look, I've seen my athletic abilities decline. And in fact, for a host of different reasons, I shouldn't be running against men. This is my identification, and this is physically where I belong in terms of her athletic abilities as well.
And so what are you expecting from the court?
So it's a bit of a mixed panel here. So we have one judge who was nominated by President Reagan for district court, and then George Herbert Walker Bush for the Ninth Circuit. And then we have two judges that were nominated by Bill Clinton for the Ninth Circuit. One of the judges, Judge Gould, 2 years ago ruled that under the Eighth Amendment, a prisoner has a right to sex reassignment surgery. And so that obviously different set of facts, different issues, but that could indicate where at least Judge Gould is thinking. Again, Judge Wardlaw is seen as a more liberal jurist, and so it could be 2-1. Again, totally hypothetical here, but it could be 2-1 in favor of upholding the district court's injunction, meaning that this law would not go into effect. Obviously, huge implications for, I think, the other 5 laws that are on the books and about the other 33 laws that are similar and bills, iterations that might be pending.
Definitely. And so is the federal government weighing in on this, the Department of Justice?
So the Department of Justice under President Trump, I think, was just about 2 weeks after the election, but of course, before the Biden administration, weighed in favor of the law, saying that the law is supported by Title IX, saying that the prohibition is supported under the Constitution.
And Merrick Garland hasn't weighed in one way or another?
No. So if the case is brought to the Supreme Court, which it could, then you could see the Department of Justice actually change tact because the administration's changed. And I think we talked about this in a couple of different scenarios. I think last time, Madeline, you and I talked about it might have been an immigration case. And so if this does go up to the Supreme Court, I would think that the Department of Justice would say, we're changing our position in this case. Merrick Garland in the confirmation hearings, I think, said some version of, I need to look at this. And he was supportive of a recent Supreme Court decision that supported anti-discrimination laws, the Bostock decision that supported the rights of the LGBT community to be free of employment discrimination.
Okay. But either way, you expect this ruling to be appealed possibly to the Supreme Court?
Either way, I think that this has Supreme Court written all over it. Now, of course, you still need 4 members of the court to decide to take the case. What they could say is, we're going to wait until there's a circuit split, meaning we're the Ninth Circuit, let's say the Ninth Circuit says, yes, there's going to be an injunction. This law will not go into effect. The Supreme Court could decide to wait until, let's say, the Fifth Circuit hears a similar case and then comes to a different conclusion. They might want a few district court cases and court of appeals to flesh out all the arguments before they take it.
All right. We will definitely keep an eye on this. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
Real estate developer, philanthropist, power broker, and of course, patron of the city's arts and architecture, Eli Broad was a force in Los Angeles for decades.
I don't think I push people around, but I'm very direct, and I'm very determined, and I have strong beliefs, and I want to move forward with things.
Eli Broad died on Friday. We'll talk about his legacy next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Real estate developer and philanthropist Eli Broad died Friday. He was 87 years old. But his name survives, most noticeably, on museums he helped build. The Broad Museum downtown, the Broad Contemporary at LACMA. He was also an important figure behind the Disney Concert Hall, arguably LA's most iconic building. It was an unlikely trajectory for a man who made billions building tract homes. How he made his money and what he used it for are central to Broad's complicated architectural legacy. We're going to talk about that now with Carolina Miranda, columnist for the LA Times, who covers art and architecture. Hi there.
Hello.
Well, it's not unheard of for real estate developers to become patrons in the art world. And so there is that, of course, and he made tons and tons of money. But it's interesting. When you look at how he made his money in terms of these tract homes and what he then contributed his money for in terms of Los Angeles architecture and art, how he chose architects with big pedigrees. He wanted to make a big statement artistically, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Eli Broad was a founder of KB Home. KB Home made a name for itself at being able to build tract housing cheaper and more easily. Part of that was by doing away with things like basements and garages, building on smaller lots, doing construction within 40 days. That was one of the things that the firm was known for. Yet Eli Broad, as a patron, was really important to bringing some really important big name architects to Los Angeles, either in whole or in part. I mean, oftentimes these are collaborative ventures, of course, but, you know, Diller, Scofidio, and Renfro, who designed his namesake museum. He worked with Renzo Piano on BCAM at LACMA. Richard Meyer, who also designed the Getty, did the art center that bears his and Edie's name at UCLA. And he was part of the teams that worked on the fundraising for Disney Hall, which was designed by Frank Gehry. And then also he had a role in the Wolf pre-designed performing arts high school that's right there on the other side of the 101. So Eli Broad had his hand in a lot of really important Los Angeles architecture.
Oh, absolutely. Well, let's talk about his complicated relationship with Frank Gehry. This went back decades, long before the construction of the Disney Concert Hall. How did their relationship begin?
Well, he commissioned, I don't know exactly under what circumstances they met, but in the late 1980s, Broad commissioned Gehry to design a house for him in Brentwood. And Gehry did it only under the agreement that he would not have a time limit, nor would he have like a budget imposed on him. Well, about 2 years into the project, Eli Broad decides that, okay, he's tired of waiting. and he doesn't, I guess he doesn't want to spend any more money. And he basically, you know, pays Frank Gehry his fee and then takes some of those drawings and has another architect build them, which, you know, is a huge insult in the architectural world. It's like saying, okay, I'm going to take your draft story and then we're going to run it under somebody else's byline. And Gehry was furious. Gehry refused to ever set foot in the house. He wouldn't claim it as one of his works of architecture. I mean, I think certainly for an architect of the stature of Gehry and many architects who work in that league, you know, they are involved from beginning to end on a project. They don't just hand over drawings and then they're done. But, and, you know, and this gets one of the complicated factors of the of how Eli Broad functioned as an architectural patron, in that he often brought his business mind to his art, to his work in the arts. And while while that meant he could often be a quite efficient administrator, it also meant taking, you know, the metrics of business and the timelines of business to things that are art forms, and, you know, insulting Frank Gehry by having somebody else build his house. And, you know, then something similar happened with Disney Hall, in which Gehry was he was going to do the working drawings. Those are the drawings that are used for the construction of the building for Disney Hall. Broad thought they were taking too long. And so he wanted to give the working drawings to another firm, and Gehry threatened to walk off the project. One of the Disney family members backed him up. Broad had to back down. I mean, it was kind of this famous, almost like Western movie standoff.
Two towering egos across the street from like each other, across Grand, battling it out.
Aiming guns at each other, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, I think those stories get at this kind of very complicated patron that Eli Broad was, that he was very important to in terms of working with these people and making many of these projects happen. But then once he got into it, you know, it wasn't always the sort of artistically nurturing relationship one might hope for from a patron.
Right. Although he did admit that Frank Gehry was right all along. So
he did. That. And that's probably one of the few times that Eli Broad has was right.
But how does that, yeah. Well, he was also an art, you know, famous art collector. And in fact, his namesake museum right there on Grand is a home for his art. So how did he view art when you look at how he viewed, you know, architecturally significant buildings?
I think, you know, it's interesting. I think it goes a little back to his view of Los Angeles, and that, you know, Eli Broad was somebody who, when he first landed in Los Angeles, and he's talked about this in interviews, about how he was a little mystified by the city with no center. And one of the things that he was consistently talking about as an architectural patron, and then in his role in the development of Grand Avenue, was, you know, comparing LA to European cities, that he wanted to turn Grand Avenue into the Champs-Élysées, and using these kind of European models to make LA an important place. And I think that translates to his art collecting too. You know, his collection is strongest in New York artists, and in big name New York artists, the Andy Warhols, the Jean-Michel Basquiat's, the Jeff Koons. And I think it was that idea sometimes of, okay, I want to work with important, incredible artists, but oftentimes in his mind, those important, incredible artists were not from LA.
Right. And yet you look at Grand Avenue, and it could be named Eli Broad Avenue, given all of the buildings there that bear his influence, from MoCA, you know, down to the high school. So
exactly.
That is significant. And I guess I'm wondering, well, without him, sure, he has a complicated legacy, but he did contribute a lot to the city. Where would downtown be? Where would Grand be? And where would a lot of these arts institutions be?
That is a good question. I mean, I imagine Eli Broad's collection would be over at LACMA in BCAM, which was the whole purpose of that building. You know, he promised to give his collection to LACMA, or sort of, it was understood that he was going to give his collection to LACMA. And that was the purpose of constructing the Broad Contemporary Art Museum. And then at the last minute, he announced that no, he was not going to give them their collection, his collection, and he was going to build his own museum. So we would be looking at a very different Grand Avenue. I think what was surprising to me is when he was building the Broad, you know, it was this whole idea of, oh, we're going to bring Grand Avenue to life. Grand Avenue had been a dead zone. It was a lot of parking lots and corporate towers. It still is not an interesting place to walk around. Yeah. And, you know, I was a little skeptical about, you know, when he would talk about like, oh, this museum is going to help like energize Grand Avenue. And, you know, it did. And I think, you know, to a big degree, that is certainly the architecture, this architecture that rather than being offset and having to go downstairs or through gates, like it greets the street, it pulls you right in. There's that great little grove with the olive trees. Mm-hmm. And the Broad Museum became a hive of activity. And I was skeptical of that. And in that regard, I was wrong. I was not expecting it to become the kind of the social center that it did. But before the pandemic, it was a really important social center for that area. And so, yeah, would things like that exist without him? No. But I'm sure that there are some executives at LACMA who are like, you know, we should be having his collection here.
Well, what about in general, in terms of being an arts patron, in terms of having a kind of an outsized vision for Los Angeles? Is there anyone like him willing to step in?
No, I mean, that's the thing. It's like he, you know, when MoCA was in trouble after spending down their endowment, like more than a decade ago, he stepped in with the $30 million check. But again, you know, then pushed the nomination of a director, Jeffrey Deitch, who ended up being quite controversial. So he was someone who was really important to the building of these institutions. A lot of these institutions may not have happened without him, or they would have happened in a very different, maybe smaller form. But there were some issues of execution here and there, I would say. And I think part of that is, you know, art and architecture are these like very collaborative. Museum administration is a very collaborative discipline. And Eli Broad was a very results-oriented businessman. And I feel like museums cannot just be judged on the metrics alone. You judge them on, you know, what aesthetic experiences do they provide? What learning about art do they bring to the world? What kind of places are they to be? And sometimes a little bit of that magic would get lost with him. But like I said, we would not have some of these places without him. And I have to say, his building, that escalator ride up to the third floor is one of my favorite escalator rides in Los Angeles, along with the Renzo Piano building that he helped bring to life at LACMA. So,
yes, a complicated, complicated man, a complicated legacy. Thank you so much, Carolina, for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Carolina Miranda, columnist for the LA Times. Coming up, we remember three hip-hop artists who died last month. Shock G, DMX, and Black Rob next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, just in the last month, the music industry lost three hip-hop icons. Rapper DMX, Bad Boy Records, Black Rob, and Digital Underground frontman Shock G. Each artist was in their 50s when they died, and each left a unique imprint on the industry. Craig Jenkins, music critic for New York Magazine, joins me now to remember them and their influence on the industry. Hello.
How's it going? Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you back. So, wow, three in 1 month of April. That's pretty incredible. And also relatively young. Were you a fan of all three?
You know, to varying extents, I was definitely a huge DMX fan, and I love, you know, the best Shock G and Digital Underground stuff and the Black Rob songs, you know, that I've come across. He had a really great first album.
Which we'll hear a little bit of in a moment. First, though, I want to talk about DMX, born Earl Simmons in Mount Vernon, New York. Had a very rough upbringing. Can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, he lived in Yonkers as a kid and in an abusive home. And also, you know, he was a very smart child, a bright child, but also sort of, you know, mischievous in a lot of ways that, you know, the handlers and the teachers and stuff in the schools didn't realize, you know, pointed to bipolar disorder. They just, the mental health, you know, community wasn't there yet. And so he bounced through the school system and he ended up, you know, in the streets doing what made the fastest money and just like really was failed by a lot of people in a lot of ways. And you know, found his way up in hip hop, you know, by hook or by crook. Took him the better part, most of the 90s to blow up.
Right. He had a really pretty rough life, and he's really open about that in his lyrics. And he went to prison many times and struggled with alcohol and drugs. So let's hear a little bit from Rough Riders Anthem. This is the radio edit. Snitches want to try, snitches want to lie, the snitches wonder why, snitches want to die. All I know is pain, all I feel is rain. I cannot maintain with madness on my brain. I resort to violence, my killers move in silence. So tell us about how he really captured the streets as opposed to some of the other rappers and hip hop artists who are more about talking about the glamour of hip hop.
You know, he was the total package. You can hear it even in that little snippet of Rough Riders Anthem. You know, there's tough guy talk. He's talking about pain. He's talking about just like, you know, connecting the different sides of life in the music. He would write about when he was struggling, and he would write about when he felt triumph. Sometimes you would hear it from one line to the next in the same song.
Interesting. And was his style and what he was rapping about, was that in opposition to the other hip hop that was going on? Did he chart a different route, a different course in hip hop?
Well, you know, he really started kind of trying to put records together in the early 90s, and I think was maybe a little bit too gruff for what was popular at the time. So it took until the late 90s when there was a sort of really different kind of tougher and more like, I don't know if profane necessarily covers it, but just like a grittier style. Like that's when he actually, you know, sort of became a major, you know, player in hip hop.
Right. And he had albums. I mean, at one point he was the most popular rapper in the world. He had one album went quadruple platinum.
Between 98 and I want to say 2000, he, in an 18-month stretch, his first three albums went platinum. So I don't think that's really something that's been repeated. You know, people have definitely put out two records in a year, but no one has done the hat trick. He was super popular. He was talking about pain and suffering, even in the party records. And I think that's something that gets kind of misunderstood about him. I think the people didn't necessarily take him seriously, who didn't, you know, come from where he came from and who didn't have an understanding of the stuff that he was talking about.
And tragically, he died of an overdose. And what was the reaction to his passing?
You know, he's a guy who has had a lot of brushes with tragedy, you know, has gone to jail for a lot of sort of like really outlandish, you know, activities and stuff. And so, you know, you always think he's going to pull back, you know, this is not going to be the thing that takes him down. And so I think people were, in spite of, you know, the difficult life that he led, we were surprised because you just think that guy's Teflon.
Well, right. But nobody is, I suppose. And so I guess I'm wondering, he was very popular in the late 90s, early 2000s. What was he doing in the last several years?
He did some features here and there. He did get a big feature on a record with The Lox, you know, his old Rough Riders buddies last summer that actually was really good. So, you know, there's always the excitement for when he was going to, you know, pull it back together and do something in keeping that with, you know, his best work. And there's a posthumous album that seems to have, you know, had some really good stuff on it that I guess we'll hear, you know, in due time. But yeah, so just a great performer and a great artist, you know, heart on his sleeve, who you just never counted him out.
All right. Well, let's now talk about Robert Ross, also known as Black Rob, raised in Harlem and best known for his work with P. Diddy at Bad Boy Records. And he's probably the least famous of the three that we're talking about today. Let's hear a little bit from his song, Whoa. I'm beat like whoa. Joints be bobbing, B, we greet like whoa. Hear my name in these streets like whoa. Must I pound the concrete like whoa. Feel his rich ass at the feet like whoa. Your man ain't whoa. The judge ain't whoa. That was his big hit, right? So tell us more about him and his sound.
Definitely a storytelling kind of an artist. You know, he would tell crime stories. His debut album, Life Story, there was a lot of like really intricate storytelling and stuff. Whoa, hit at a peculiar moment for Bad Boy Records because the label was kind of falling off. You know, Diddy had been embroiled in that whole thing with the shootout where J-Lo was involved, that the rapper Shine got locked up. Hmm. And so there was this question as to whether Bad Boy Records had, you know, seen its last hit, and Woe came along and sort of revitalized everyone. So, and also is in the pantheon of just great New York rap records that you can still, you know, play at a party. And so I feel that he has, he's underrated, but he also has a place in, you know, the history of this juggernaut of hip hop commercialism.
All right. Well, speaking of a party, let's move on to Shock G from Digital Underground. And he's sort of almost the opposite of DMX, right? I mean, he's sort of a party guy, kind of, you know, funny and in with his, I don't know, his alter egos. He's got, you know, of course, Humpty Hump, and we all know the Humpty Hump. Let's play a song, though, that is not as well known. It's called Kiss You Back.
Yo, it's not funny. Real cute is what you say to me. But any other way you're playing me, if you love me, then I'll love you back.
When you say I get the most out of this, it kind of bothers me. A fair exchange and no robbery.
Love me, girl, and I love you back.
Love me, girl, and I love you back.
Now I'm hoping that you hear me, cause I love it when you hear me. And you know I know you need me, so I guess that we could do this.
Kiss me and I'll kiss you back.
So, yeah, super easy, likable. I think people think of him as kind of, he was goofy and entertaining. Tell us more about him.
You know, a fun-loving guy, a musician, a producer, you know, a sort of mastermind of a lot of things. You know, had the Digital Underground group that sort of, you could argue, drew a bridge between hip-hop and, you know, classic funk as much as the Dr. Dre stuff gets credit for. Hmm. As beloved by the people in the actual Parliament Funkadelic Collective, I would say. So, yeah, he just literally and figuratively wore many hats and made a lot of different kinds of music, played around with, you know, an alter ego and stuff, but just like an unpredictable character, you know, in style and in music.
Yeah, and so he was really influenced by George Clinton and Parliament, Funkadelic, and so tell us more about that. How did they they loved him back? They thought they liked him and Digital Underground as well.
Yes, I believe it was Bootsy Collins spoke out, you know, in the wake of his passing and had, you know, paid his respects. Hmm. These guys, their first album, Digital Underground, their first album, Sex Package, is sort of like, you know, in the spirit of the old Parliament Records, kind of a concept album with a ridiculous sort of like, you know, inappropriate like concept, but that was also really funny and then out of the box and intelligent. And so, you know, they took inspiration and they also were respected by the guys who, you know, inspired them, which is kind of rare. And I mean, Shock G definitely is in the Hip Hop Hall of Fame for introducing us all to Tupac, who we put on some of the early Digital Underground records and who we produced for.
Right. I didn't realize that Tupac was actually a member of the group early on.
Yeah. And I would say some of the greatest solo Tupac songs are Shock G productions. He did I Get Around and he did the song So Many Tears, two of the best songs Tupac ever did.
Oh, wow. So he was really influential, Shock G.
Yeah, to those in the know. Digital Underground didn't necessarily get the commercial, you know, heyday that it deserved. It was kind of, you know, if you were topside, if you weren't, you know, really involved in the culture, you might have only heard the Humpty Dance and or the Kiss You Back song. Mm-hmm. But those records stand up to this day.
So that was late 80s, early 90s. And
yeah.
And we're talking that mainly these three were active in that early 90s to late 90s time period.
Yeah. The thing that I find fascinating about them that I was, you know, attempting to articulate is that they each blew up a different sort of phase in that decade, even though they were all, you could argue, the same age and were coming up around the same time. It's really tough to get into the industry. And then, you know, once the sort of hits run dry, it's, you know, if whatever money that you had set aside is what, you know, your situation is. You know, Black Rob had a lot of health issues. And even though Bad Boy kept him on the label for a long time, he didn't really get the shine that he deserved anymore, to the extent that in the last days of his life, there was a GoFundMe for his health. Hmm. And So there's that. You know, you can be a hit maker, you can be a valuable asset to the company, and, you know, in 10 years, you might be on the street. It's kind of a rough situation. And there's not the infrastructure that there is in hip-hop, you know, the way there is in rock and roll, where, you know, you can go on a package tour or, you know, television. Sometimes hip-hop just spits you out, and you're left to your devices.
Yeah. So unless you're actually a mogul, you've turned it around and become like a producer or an executive. It's hard.
Quite like football, where you give your best years to something and then your body's broken down and there's nobody coming around. That happens to a lot of greats.
Yeah. Sad, but we have their music, so that's at least something.
Yes.
Craig, thank you.
Thank you.
Craig Jenkins, music critic at New York Magazine. So now I'm going to do my dance. All right, that does it for us today on Press Play. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow. Do